Quick warning, the N-word is used in archival tape in this episode. April 29th, 1992. A date that forever changed Los Angeles.
Rodney King says at least one police officer called him a nigger just after he was kicked in the head while on the ground.
6 days of chaos erupted after the acquittal of four police officers and the beating of Rodney King, an unarmed black motorist.
King said he had been asked sarcastically, "How do you feel after being kicked?" King said he replied by half coughing out the blood in his mouth. Then King said a police officer said, "We're going to kill you, nigger, run." King said that remark was the only reason he did get up and try to run. But he said he was instantly hit in the head with a baton and went down again. King said officers then taunted him by saying, "Killer, killer, how do you feel, killer," while they hit him.
I'm Gustavo Arellano. You're listening to The Times, daily news from the LA Times. It's Thursday, April 28th, 2022. This is the first of two episodes on the 30th anniversary of the LA riots. Today, Black, Latino, and Asian communities reflect on the uprising, and we also discuss a racial reckoning in the LA Times newsroom that happened in the riots' aftermath. Joining me today are my fellow LA Times columnists, Sandy Banks and Frank Xiong. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sandy, I want to start with you because you covered the riots in real time. But before we get to what happened, it's important to remember what were the issues leading up to April 29th, especially with the Black community.
Yeah, you're right, Gustavo. It was a very different time from now. Crime was out of control in South LA. We had crack cocaine. We had a lot of gangs and drugs. There was a lot of tension between the community and the police. The police were seen as the enemy. And then there was a lot of protests and all about the lack of resources in the community. There were too many liquor stores, not enough grocery stores, prices were high. And on top of that, then we had the LaTosha Harlins killing at a liquor store in the community and a trial in which the grocer who shot her was convicted of manslaughter but given probation by a white female judge who said she'd suffered enough. And that incensed the community. But still, there were no riots, no violence. But then we had Rodney King. And when the tape of that beating came out and went around the world, things just exploded. Hour of that verdict, there was rampaging in downtown.
And I think people forget, especially if you weren't born or living in that era, that the time between the Rodney King beating, the tape, and the acquittal was about a year. So you had all this tension just simmering.
It was just a spark that couldn't be extinguished.
I was 14 at the time, and I just remember all the anger. Frank, you were even younger than me and in Tennessee at the time. But one of the things that you've written about a lot in your columns was this alleged friction between the Korean and Black community. And it really came to a head the year before the riots when a Korean liquor store owner, Soon Ja Do, when she shot and killed 15-year-old LaTosha Harlins, a Black girl.
But I guess when you talk to Korean reporters reporting on these issues at the time, such as the framing also confine the racial issue of the LA riots to just these communities. And it was kind of this two-dimensional picture. Soon Ja Do's sentencing was convenient politically because it was a racial issue in which the LAPD was not at fault. It was a palatable narrative because it was a racial conflict for which white people could not be directly blamed. And it was an answer when people were looking for answers. The timing was convenient.
Soon Ja Do was convicted of killing LaTosha Harlins in no small part because of the video footage of the scene. And that just brought racial tensions to a head right before Rodney King.
Yeah, some people say like a tale of two videotapes, right? The CCTV footage of Soon Ja Do shooting LaTosha Harlins and the video of the Rodney King beating. The CCTV footage shows a violent exchange between the shopkeeper, Soon Ja Do, and the teenager, LaTosha Harlins, who had placed a bottle of juice in her backpack. In her left hand, she had $2 and she was coming up to pay, but Soon Ja Do reached over the counter and grabbed her sweater and pulled her over, and that's when the fight began. And Soon Ja Do was knocked down a few times and then came back up with a gun, and as LaTosha placed the orange juice on the counter and walked out of the shop, she was shot in the back of the head by Soon Ja Do. But the Soon Ja Do shooting was not an isolated phenomenon. You know, there were frequent shootings of Korean shopkeepers and by Korean shopkeepers of their customers, and boycotts organized in the aftermath of the Latasha Harlan shooting. And so there are these economic pain points, like Korean Americans owning, you know, the hair and beauty supply stores and swap meets, primarily patronized by Black and brown people. So, you know, the Black and Korean conflict described, you know, real friction between Black populations and Korean shopkeepers all over the United States.
I think that the Korean shopkeepers became a symbol, a reflection of a community that had been disinvested in for generations. Because it's important to remember in 1965, liquor stores were also a big issue.
1965, that was, of course, the Watts riot.
Yes, they were mostly owned by Jews. And so it was always, it's not us owning things in our own community than they were at specific shopkeepers. And so, you know, the Koreans became kind of the target for a long simmering anger that had nothing to do with them.
I just remember all the television stations immediately switched on. You see fires, you see people looting the stores. For me, though, the biggest surprise was just seeing so many Latinos being part of it. And I say this with shame because a lot of us were saying, oh, we're better, you know, we're better than that, which is like total coded anti-Blackness and ignorant because those of us who weren't living in South LA hadn't realized that the area was already majority Latino or getting to be majority Latino.
Yes, it was. You know, there was like equal opportunity looting because all of the people in South Los Angeles had been disenfranchised financially in, you know, in many ways. And so now you have people going after the Safeways and the shoe stores. And well, the looters were taking things like diapers and formula. And even the police officer said, I can't bother them. You know, these are people who are stealing necessity in a moment of opportunity and in a moment of anger, because I know many Latinos felt that could have been us. That very easily could have been us on that side. It was shocking to some people, but it was a very human reaction to an inhumane decision.
I spoke to Aurea Montes Rodriguez. She's the vice president of a nonprofit down in South LA called Community Coalition. She's also native of South LA, and her memories of the riot are vivid.
Well, so, you know, my brother, we got in his pickup truck and we started driving and we saw a lot of Latino immigrants that were looting our grocery store. People were coming out with diapers, with milk, with basic essentials. And there were stores where people were taking out televisions and technology equipment. And what I remember was that when we got back to our house, one of our neighbors who was Black and whose family members lived on the street, so they had multiple homes that they owned, said, we are not going to bring any of the looting onto this street. I just remember thinking, like, that's right, even though this injustice happened, we can't be burning our neighborhood down. We can't be looting stores. And he was communicating a sense of pride for our street.
More on the LA riots after the break. Sandy, when do you remember seeing the Rodney King videotape for the first time?
Seeing the video was a kind of a validation. It was painful to watch, but it was kind of validation. But it's also important to know that it wasn't just beatings that had the Black community so exhausted and incensed. It was the daily indignities. Like even my husband, who's Black, we live in the Valley, Northridge, was stopped more often than he could count by police. Just wanted to say, you know, where are you going? Like, what are you doing out here? And just the daily indignities that motorists of color, and it happened to Latinos too, had to put up with. And so seeing the video was like showing to the world what we already knew.
Everyone was just disgusted by it. And so it wasn't really much of a surprise that the LA district attorney at the time charged the police officers involved. Do you think people were surprised though, Sandy, that they were acquitted?
Oh, yeah. The seminal decision was moving the trial to Simi Valley, which is where many, many, many Los Angeles police officers live. That's considered, you know, their stomping ground. And so you were not going to get a jury that was representative of the city of Los Angeles. So that alarmed some people. And I think there were a lot of people that said, oh, there's, you know, no way we're going to get a conviction out there. But most people, and our polls showed that most Black people particularly felt okay about it. They were convinced that once you see this video, there's no way you can not convict these officers.
The defense insists that it's more important what the officers thought than what they did. Defense attorneys don't admit the officers violated police policy. But even if they did, the lawyers say, that does not mean they violated King's civil rights. The argument
I would say it was a shock, and people gathered very quickly to protest it. They left their jobs, they walked out of whatever they were doing, and they showed up at police headquarters, you know, to protest and to throw rocks and to vent their anger.
Yeah, the protests at first were just angry, but then you just started seeing violence. One of the most lasting images of the riots for many people is of Reginald Denny. He was a white truck driver. He was dragged out on the corner of Florence and Normandy, and not just beaten, but had a cinder block thrown at his head, and people celebrating this was happening. That was just so horrific.
That was horrific, and it was particularly horrific because it was filmed by news crews, helicopters who were above, and they could really zoom in. And so that also went out around the world immediately. And I can remember us standing in the newsroom watching it happen in real time. And, you know, and the young reporters, too, was like, this is what I'm going out into. And I always wondered, is that why they, you know, didn't want to send white reporters down there?
Yeah, when I think of the Reginald Denny clip, I think of how many times I've seen it. You know, I think I've probably seen it as many times as the Rodney King clip.
We talk about Reginald Denny getting beaten, but another person that was beaten just an hour afterwards, almost as savagely, was a Guatemalan immigrant named Fidel Lopez. And his story was basically forgotten. Like, it definitely did not get the coverage. And it was also recorded live at the same time as well.
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember the stories of the people who helped were not told either. I mean, there were lots of people there who were dragging these people out of harm's way.
Reginald Denny describes his trip through Florence and Normandy. He first saw chaos at the intersection. Then he was attacked. Here he is questioned by Prosecutor Janet Moore.
Do you have any recollection of the events after that?
No, just being really startled. I mean, almost like gasping a last breath kind of thing, you know, where probably my heart was pounding like crazy because it was very unnerving, I guess would be a good way of putting it.
I believe his eventual rescuer or protector was the Black man who saw what was happening on the TV and ran out of his home to save this man.
Sandy, where were you when the verdict was announced, and what scenes from the riots are seared in your mind?
I was at my desk, like everyone in the newsroom. We were all watching television because they had announced the verdict was about to come down. And it's even still hard to talk about now because I couldn't imagine that an entire jury would vote to acquit. I thought either they would convict or there would be a hung jury. So I just remember when the verdict was announced, feeling dizzy and feeling like someone had physically punched me in the chest, like I couldn't breathe. And it went silent in my part of the newsroom. And I was the only Black reporter in that little area then. And I could see my colleagues' faces just went ashen. No one knew what to say. It was a shock. And, you know, your first thought as a reporter is usually, okay, what am I going to do now? You know, what am I going to write about? What am I going to say? But I couldn't even think about that. I actually stood up and packed my bags and walked out of the newsroom. And I would never see myself doing that, turning away from such a great story. It was an emotional and even it felt like a physical blow.
Frank, what's your reaction to all of it?
Well, I think like as an Asian American, I'm most affected by it is how Sun Jia Du kind of became the face of racism for the LA riots, even more so than the LAPD. It's almost as if, you know, white racism kind of has existed behind this rhetorical fortress, and this timidity with respect to characterizing white racism leads to headlines like, you know, racially tinged shooting. And nowadays, you know, we're all sort of more aware that, you know, racism is a part of a system that keeps us all down, you know, that racism is not only committed by racists and people in KKK hoods, it's a part of our society that's reflected in institutions and discourse, and all of us are capable of participating in actions with racist consequences.
You know, what's ironic too, Frank, is when you look back on this, Blacks and Koreans were victims in much the same way because the police made a conscious decision not to go in and stop the violence, stop the looting. The word traveled was that the chief didn't want to have any more videos of Black people being beaten. So let's just stand back and leave it alone. And so Korean shop owners who many lost everything, lost their livelihoods and have never recovered, were penalized by that because the government did not come to their aid as victims. And the government did not come to the aid of Black people. So we were both let down by the government that we, you know, expected and counted on to help us.
What I worry about is it a self-fulfilling prophecy, preventing us from seeing Blacks and Koreans as individuals? When you look back at what the Korean-American groups at the time said about the Soon Ja Do verdict and the Latasha Harlan's verdict, nobody really backed up Soon Ja Do. You know, it was only her church group, you know, that showed up at the trial. These bigger groups that purportedly represented the Korean community understood that this was a miscarriage of justice.
More after the break. Sandy, at the beginning of our conversation, you said, obviously, things are far more different today than they were 30 years ago. And one of the things that has changed immensely has been our organization, our paper, the Los Angeles Times. What was it like during the riots?
It was very tense in our newsroom, and it was very difficult. We did not have many reporters of color. I think we had two Korean reporters, five or six Black reporters, probably five or six Latino reporters, maybe not even that many. It was 30 years ago. I can't remember it all.
But. And this is a time when there was over 1,000 reporters at the Los Angeles Times.
What we did have, we had a core of young reporters of color in our MetPro training program. They were all learning to be reporters. And so the news desk called on them to go out into the riot zone to get color, you know, which they would interview people and basically risk their lives. And they would come back in excited about what they found, excited to be part of this big story. And then were told pretty much to hand over their notes to the rewrite team. And the rewrite team was invariably mostly older white men. And so their images, their voices they heard and all that was then translated through the perceptions of the rewrite team. And they had no say in what the stories would get. And they might get a byline. But that led to a real kind of uprising in the newsroom.
Like LA Times reporter Greg Braxton, here's him speaking about his experience in the newsroom at the time.
Tensions started to rise because it was charged that editors were using Black reporters as cannon fodder to go out into the streets. And it pointed out how Black reporters weren't a usual part of Metro, but then during a crisis situation, all of a sudden we were of great value. That charge prompted a lot of defensiveness from white editors. And it just uncovered, I think, a boiling pot in the newsroom about how non-diverse the Times' main sections were in terms of having people of color. It just pointed out those inequities.
So it led to a lot of hard times. And I have to say, our editor at that time was very sensitive to what was going on and called a big town hall meeting for us to get in there and vent at each other. And we did. And there was anger and there was crying and there was a lot of emotion. But I think we came out of that as a better organization and felt freer to speak our minds going forward. So it was a growing point for us in a time when we had to pivot and realize our responsibility to not just white readers, but all readers.
Frank, in reading the coverage at the time, what strikes you about it?
What strikes me, I guess, is that people were looking for someone to blame for the riots. And that was kind of the subtext of all of the different conversations. Because who got the blame also determined who got the funds for rebuilding. I saw Black voices and Korean voices reflecting on what went wrong between those two communities, but I don't hear so much white voices reflecting on how the political situation that created the LAPD at the time might have been responsible for the issues as well, how historically racist practices led to Blacks and Koreans competing for resources in South LA, how white-centric media struggled to produce, you know, journalism that reflected all sides of the issue.
30 years later, there's all these iconic images, but there's one iconic audio clip. Rodney King, a couple days into the riots, going in front of cameras at a press conference and saying,
Can we all get along? Can we get along?
And today, the issues that were around in 92, they still exist. And Frank and Sandy, I wonder, how much did we actually hear Rodney King when he said that? Like, did anyone learn his lesson of trying to get along?
I think we heard him and we felt his pain, and he was agitated about all of this happening on his behalf. But I tell you, I had an experience that made me think that we can only all get along if some of us are willing to suffer privately. And it goes to what Frank said. A few days into the riot, I was at home and I was not working on it. It was on a Saturday, and I took my daughter to a little birthday party at a park, 4 years old, and it was all white. It was her friends from preschool. And I was exhausted, smelled like smoke. I sat at a picnic table just to sit there and, you know, watch them. And at the other end were two white mothers. And I don't know if they'd been talking about the riots before, but once I sat down on the other end, they said, oh, isn't that horrible about what's happening over the hill? Isn't that horrible? Because we could see the smoke, you know, coming from the city. And one of them said, yeah, it almost makes you wish they didn't have that video. And I thought, she doesn't wish they didn't beat him. She doesn't wish the police were held accountable. She just wishes we didn't have to see it. And I remember thinking at that point, I could never have that thought. That thought could never occur to me.
Yeah.
And that there is this gulf between us that, you know, I don't know. Can we all get along? I guess only if some people are protected from the ugly realities of racism. And we see that today, even with the, you know, the debates over what can be taught in school about history. Let's protect some people from it. Can we all get along was a sincere and honest plea, and the jury is still out even right now.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what he meant by it, you know, and I wasn't there to sort of receive it with all the context of the time, but, like, did he mean it as a chastisement, you know? Did it mean as a recommendation, you know? Was it a pronouncement of despair, you know, like, can we all get along? No.
But what's sad to me about it is that we're talking about its sincerity, but all these years later, when you still hear it in Southern California, it's a joke. It's a stock line. People say it sarcastically. Yeah. So it's sad. Like, when I think about it now and I remember him shaking, he was so nervous. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately people started making fun of him. Like, oh yeah, you really think we're going to get along? Good luck, man.
Yeah. I mean, and imagine him. He gets called upon. Here's this riot happening on his behalf. And he's told, you have to say something. And this was all he could come up with. And he became caricature, basically, too.
I mean, I think that question underlies a lot of reporting about communities of color, right? Can we all get along? And there are examples of yes and examples of no. You see, like, a lot of Koreans and Latinos in Koreatown also still in the sort of same competition of resources. With, there are still instances of labor friction. For me, the answer is just both. You know, we can get along, and there are examples of that, and there are difficulties as well.
You know, and there were some things that happened that we can't overlook that were good that came out of the riots that also helped to reduce some of that friction. The number of liquor stores in South Los Angeles declined dramatically. Policing changed dramatically. The whole concept of community policing came out of the riots. The commission, you know, that oversees the police department, all that came out of the riots. There was a consent decree that we had to comply with. So there were things, fundamental structural things, that helped to change and create the ability for us to be more cohesive.
Sandy Banks, Frank Xiong, thank you again for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sandy, Frank, and myself all have columns on the 30th anniversary of the LA riots. It's part of a package, along with our colleagues, about this very important part of California history. Visit latimes.com to read them all. That's it for this episode of The Times, daily news from the LA Times. Tomorrow, part two of our 30th anniversary coverage of the Los Angeles riots. We'll go down to South LA, its epicenter, and see how the economy and the neighborhoods have changed. Denise Guerra was a chef on this episode, and our show is produced by Shannon Lin, Denise Guerra, Kasha Brasalian, Ashley Brown, Angel Carreras, and David Toledo. Our editorial assistants are Madeline Amato and Carlos de Loera. Our engineer is Mario Diaz. Our editor is Kinsey Morton. Our executive producers are Jasmine Aguilera and Shawnee Hilton. And our theme music is by Andrew Epin. Like what you're listening to? Then make sure to follow The Times on whatever platform you use. I'm Gustavo Arellano. We'll be back tomorrow with all the news and desmadre. Gracias.